This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
I feel the energy in the studio. I'm energized. A bit of the first hour, it's a bit of a challenge, but the youth in the house, and I think they're going to be... The chemistry is going to flow throughout the 1 hour because we're going to talk about a number of issues on the Thought Council. Let me introduce them, starting with Nonhle Skhosana. Good morning, Nonhle. Are you good?
I'm good, thank you.
Yeah, you were. I think I saw you on television, if I'm not mistaken. But you were at the GBV march, towards the JSE.
Yes.
Fun, incredible experience, but I think at the same time, sending a powerful message to the country.
Of course.
Yeah, well, indeed. There we're gonna talk more about that march and the experiences, especially the timing of it. That was incredible. When women do things, they do them in a unique way. So we're gonna go back to that. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. You're passionate about the issues of leadership, and you're saying Africa, they call it a young continent, but look at our leaders, eh?
Yeah.
Some, they can't even walk.
Quite disappointing.
When are young people taking over in this continent?
Yeah, no one is going to give it to us. We just have to take it ourselves.
Aha, uh-huh. It seems as if Tunisia Day is coming. Okay, we have to wait. We have to wait and see. The Arab Spring, yeah, it's going to then. And then we have Thulani Maphasa. He's a master's candidate and thought leader. You are passionate about issues of xenophobia, Afrophobia, and why? Have you done some research about it? Or have you just been driven by the current status quo?
I think both yeah. factors have contributed in my interest, both as like a researcher, but also as just prevailing situation in the country.
All right. And I think you guys are very much observant of what has been happening in the country, particularly pertaining to issues of gender-based violence. Okay. But Nonhle, starting with you, I mean, we saw issues of femicides, yes. issues of, you know, gender-based violence. Our women in this country are under siege. And I know I've been called out on this program to say, stop calling us our women because you don't take care of us. But anyway, I'm just going to say it, our women, because my woman, it's my woman, because I know I love her. My sisters are my sisters, so I will use that phrase. But I mean, it started off with a summit, you know, where the president and some cabinet ministers came through. And there were some pouring of feelings in that thing. But there was a time as if you guys were getting a bit frustrated that the gender summit has happened and nothing is happening. Why was that?
If you remember correctly, after the total shutdown march last year, we had 24 demands that we submitted to to the presidency. Out of those 24 demands, like some of them, a lot of them have not been met. And the deadline for those 24 demands was like this August. So now we're still, they're still in the process of developing the national strategic plan. But I mean, other than like developing it and still being in like the, you know, like negotiations for that, nothing much has really happened in terms of like response to the 24 demands and like response to effective and physical response to gender-based violence and femicide in this country.
Yeah, so the reluctance, you know, for government to show leadership in this particular
yes.
issue somehow compelled you guys to escalate the matter, and you came up with this important march where you said, by the way, the problem is not only
government
related,
yes.
but you have to look at the private sector.
Yes,
as well.
Definitely.
I think it was a smart move. What really inspired that?
So, you know what? Private sector has always put themselves back. They've always kept quiet when it comes to issues on gender-based violence and femicide in this country. They're so silent to a point where they almost like extricate themselves from it as if it doesn't affect them. But we all know that there are incidences in the private sector that happen where, you know, women were sexually assaulted at the workplace, and you know, just things like, you know, the gender gap pay and like, you know, all these like gendered issues that they experience, they keep quiet about them. So what we want to do is to go to them and be like, you can't sit away from this. Like, you cannot keep quiet about what is happening in this country, because it affects you as much as it affects us. Like, you know, the women that are working and that are crying and that are saying that enough is enough are the same women who work for you on a daily basis that you need to acknowledge and need to take initiative and start doing something about it. So going to the JSC was a collective move, like a civil society collective move, to be like, they need to be held accountable for like things that they're not doing, because we also understand that they don't have policies that like are geared towards the eradication of gender-based violence within the work space. Like, they don't have enough things that are conducive enough for them to be like, okay, we're going to use these as tools to make sure that the gender gap within the workspace is, you know, shortened. Like,
yeah,
they don't have that. So it's not enough for them to wear black and and say we stand with our women. We're not your women, because that you're making us your property, which is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Which is part of the problem again. Is when you say our women, you buy into what is the actual problem. The actual problem is that we're treated as property and we're not property. And that's the problem. Like, we are not property. We are also humans that bleed the same blood, that experience the same pain. Like, we're humans and we need to be treated like that in this country. We need to be acknowledged as humans. Like, we're not anybody's property for you to be able to make decisions for us. I'm not a puppet. I can make my own choices. I've got my own agency. Like, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's look at the campaigns, like your hashtags and so on. Sometimes it worries me that campaigns like your hashtag men are trash, and then you come up with another, you know, campaign and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, I feel like it seems as if there can be some kind of a commitment, not a campaign, something that will come up meaningfully and bring a meaningful change. Let's look at these campaigns like your hashtags and whatever. Do you think they are working in terms of delivering whatever messages that have been sent, whether to government or private sector or to the country in general?
I mean, you know what? With popular media, you can't really say much. You know, like the campaigns. I mean, Twitter is an effective form of mobilization. We can't negate that. So when you have a hashtag, it is embedded in discourse. You can't negate that. So when you have things like men are trash, like it is a statement that makes you want to look at, like, why is it that we're saying men are trash? Like, what discourse is embedded in that one statement that we're saying men are trash? Like, what is it relative to? I mean, South Africans are very, they like camaraderie. They like, you know, jumping onto the bandwagon. They like, you know, things that are happening right now. They like, you know, being part of the hype. So a hashtag is a catchy way to be like, actually, wait, whoa, like, think about what you're doing. Think about what this campaign is about. You know, think about, because the thing is that campaigns are campaigns. They are there to raise awareness. Mm. What needs to happen on a presidential level and on a government level is for implementation to take place. It's not that we don't have policies, you know, towards the eradication of gender-based violence. We do have policies that exist. We just don't have the proper implementation. Like, we had a joint sitting of Parliament this Wednesday. In that joint sitting, how much was given? 1.1 billion towards GBV. Is that good? That's good. But how are we going to make sure that 1 billion is used for the eradication of gender-based violence? Because we know that there's a lot of corruption happening, yes, within the government sector. We know that. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's things like that where you say, creating awareness is one part of it, but also implementation and that is has to be done at a government level, because we as civil society organizations cannot do that. We can do the research, we can tell you what's wrong, we can give you the answers to what can be done, but we can't put the protocols in place because we don't have that power. So then it becomes an issue of power and how that power is used.
Yeah. From the law enforcement agencies to the efficiency of the courts to many other things. Tulani, this issue is not a problem for women. It's a societal problem. What role do we play as men? Because we are perpetrators in the majority. So how do we, what kind of role do we play?
I think there are a number of things that we can do as men in terms of addressing gender-based violence. But I think the most pertinent and immediate action, I mean, as the conversation has been taking place on Twitter, is about calling each other out, right? And so what has just happened now with Nontle, in a sense, contesting what you're saying about our women and so on, right? That's something that men should be doing, right, first and foremost. But I think more importantly is listening. And I don't think that is happening, right? Mm. There was an incident where someone tweeted about on the week where everything was happening, right, where the country seemed to be exploding. And a lady tweeted that with everything that has been happening, she went to a store, and when she left the store, men catcalled her and then said gender-based violence and then started laughing, right? It's very dismissive, and it doesn't show any urgency in terms of listening to the conversation, right? But I think Nontle is right in saying that we need an institutional kind of level of addressing the matter, right? Yeah. It doesn't really help when you have people who are in high positions of power in the ANC, and the DA, EFF, and in government who have been alleged to be perpetrators and so on and so forth, and people who are in high-level powers don't really address that, right? They say it's a matter of the courts to deal with, right? When we know that the courts themselves are riddled with gendered kind of bias, right? And so I think that's, there are many things. We can participate and so on, but I think, one, as men, we need to listen. We need to call each other out. But also, I think at an institutional level, we need a much more proactive and much more engaged and a response that actually listens to what women are saying, right?
Let's go to Ubakeng Lesiane. You are in the education space, and, you know, beyond listening, you know, the issue of, you know, the issue of sharing information, and not just sharing information for the sake of sharing information, but making sure that there is education that goes along with it. From an education perspective, what kind of interventions can we think of?
So firstly, I think that there's a part of educating someone and saying, surely this is not enough because you didn't see a change behavior. Mm. And I think when it comes to gender-based violence, a lot of men know that it's wrong, but there's this idea that I am probably going to get away with it because institutions are failing, or people around me, just to be quite frank, don't call me out. So for me, education really, really does not stop at the point of sharing information. It's it like stops, or maybe starts at the point of actually acting, right? To say that a big part of people learning about consent, a big part of people learning about forums, platforms for them to share their pain and hopefully be taken seriously, is that something is going to be done about it. But I think we are way past the stage of people not knowing. It's just that people now know, and what do they do about it, or what don't they do about it? And at the part of what they don't do about it, that's when it's then important to have institutions as well as people on a very grassroots level enforcing that. That for me, sometimes when I sit back and then I listen to a woman say that she went to a police station and tried to report a case, and they told her that it's your husband, how can she rape you? Those types of conversations for me are very, very dangerous, because it A, speaks to the fact that the people that we have entrusted to serve and protect are not really fulfilling the duty that they've been mandated for, and B, that there is a misuse of power there.
Yeah,
because typically it's the male police officers who are like often saying these type of statements to like women, that I'm like, next time a woman is raped, she's also going to doubt herself of, was this rape? Because the type of response that she gets makes her really doubt the truth that she has come forward with. For education, for me, it's not enough to share information. It's about, okay, you know, and what do you do? And if someone doesn't do anything, what are some of the mechanisms that we can put in place to ensure that there is strong enforcement, and that enforcement is also held to account?
Yeah. 22 minutes after the hour, 10 o'clock, Power Talk. It is with me, Murio Sanyane. I'm standing in for Aldrin St. Pierre. This is the Thought Council. My special guest, Nontle Skosana, GBV activist at the Archive Amabala Wethu, as well as Obakeng Lesiane, education advocate, emerging thought leader, and Thulane Maphasa is a thought leader and a master's candidate. We are talking about a variety of issues, but starting with the issues of gender-based violence, which are occupying our country. And very interesting that it went into parliament. That was extremely, extremely important that a joint sitting of parliament, it was called in, a number of issues that were said. But you see, Nontle, why I spoke about the education and the information. While I was in primary, and that's many moons ago, I was about to, with a group of obviously men, young boys, having to graduate from primary to middle school. Because you grew up in the Bantu stands of Botswana, so they introduced this middle school thing. There was a lady teacher, Mam Wema, who addressed us. She says, you are now going to middle school. You're going to start wearing long pants. Start going to be attracted to young girls or, you know, to ladies, to girls. And he said, there's something that is very much important. It's a no. When you call a girl who wants to talk to you and she says no, walk away. When he wants to, and he was saying in Setswana to say, "O batla go feria mostana," and I don't know, "Aughana," walk away, because there are many others. You know, those words stood with me from a primary level to accept and understand and know. So that is why the issue of education, but also the communication part, to say how do we communicate these particular issues. Now, so let's come to what the EFF member of parliament said. She even asked the question after the presentation to say, I want to know from the number one citizen of this country, the president, and all men in this parliament, as to whether any time in their lives they've abused or assaulted women. It was an important question.
It was a very important question.
So what does it say to us as a society? How do we take those messages from parliament into the ordinary men and women in the street, particularly men, of course?
I think, you know what, I think her asking that question was like quite like pertinent, simply because we never think to check ourselves. Like, we're so complacent in the violence that occurs, like, you know, on a daily, you know, we perpetuate that violence. We are very much complacent with the violence that happens in this country. So when you talk about gender-based violence, like, you can't talk about it from a place where you remove yourself. You know, you're not far removed from the problem itself, because maybe in the house you talk to, you know, your significant other in a certain manner, you know, maybe you guys treat each other in a way that has violent overturns. Like, you know, there's so many ways that we play into violent, like, into violence that we don't even recognize. So it's to say that, like, if you want to really know how big the problem is in South Africa, ask yourself, how many times did you be complicit or enact a violent act on somebody, like, you know, one of the two, like, to look at yourself and be like, have I been complacent in actually what's happening? Because even as women, we've been complacent. You know, your friend, you're at a party, your friend is a little bit drunk, you can see that she's not okay, but you're gonna let her go with some guy that she doesn't know. She wakes up the next morning, she's blacked out, she doesn't remember a goddamn thing.
Yeah. Responsibility, responsibility, responsibility. Okay.
Yeah.
Finally, let's talk, Thulane, about the issues of implementation. Okay. I think we all know that even the National Planning Commissioners in the NDP, they make us aware that as South Africans, we've got these good policies, strategies. Nontle was not talking about a strategic framework is going to be developed and so on. But the biggest problem is the implementation and execution of those things. So how do we, as a country, and here I'm talking from a government point of view, from a corporate kind of view, point of view, and from a civil society point of view, because you look even in corporates, you've got King 1 to King 4, isn't it? Code of, you know, good governance. But look at how we mess up corporate governance. And even some companies, big corporates, they run workshops and King 1 to King 4 and so on and so forth. But how do we start to say, whatever that we agree on, let's implement and execute it and stop making all these forums just talk shops? How do we change that mindset and make sure that we implement?
I think there are a number of things which can take place, right? But I think what is the most imperative is that there has to be a political will to do that, right? In the absence of political will, then you're going to have disjointed initiatives, right? Where you're going to have forum after forum, right? And that is not to say, rather that civil society in most parts has provided the solutions, right? This is a conversation which dates back many years, right? And so there are solutions in place. I know that President Ramaphosa has announced a 5-point plan that's going to supposedly tackle gender-based violence, right? But I think the most important measure at present is accountability, right? In the workspace, in different spaces. And that also means capacitating public officials, that means capacitating the corporate world in terms of institutional culture, in terms of employing the right people who are going to undertake the implementation of these kinds of programs, right?
Yeah, okay. Those are some of the practical things that we can focus on. Ntate Ubakeng, let's now shift focus slightly and look at this issue of the of Africa being the youngest continent but having these leaders that are old and so on, and they're doing it so successfully because sometimes they embark on what we call constitutional coup d'etats. Because when a leader is about to retire, then they change the constitution and so on. So how do we stop that? Because that it means it perpetuates this arrangement that it's an old boys club from an AU level. How do we start coming up with interventions to cut it out?
I mean, like, some countries are quite fortunate enough that they have very, very strong democracies where institutions function, where people get a chance to free and fair elections. In that case, I think it just stands upon educating and mobilizing voters. But in the case where that is not the case, you look at, let's say, Uganda, where the ruling party has 80% of the parliament captured, pretty much, is that it's quite hard then to say, because ultimately most like constitutions would say that you need about 75% of the vote to just amend something. So when you have leadership that has captured even some of the people that are meant to be guardians of the republic, such as the judiciary, financial services, independent sectors, it then becomes quite hard. And that's when you then say, you know what, people now have to take it to the streets. But then sometimes when like people take it to the streets, people die. We don't even have to look at far, we just look at Zimbabwe, is that violence is such a big part of the like political culture there, that people live with this fear of any form of mobilizing is me putting my life on the line for ultimately death. That people, like, I was telling some dude that I just bumped into that I think it's quite sad that Zimbabwe in the past almost 40 years has only known two presidents.
and
whom both of them are fairly one of the same, I mean two of the same thing.
Yeah.
That I'm like, at least in South Africa, we do have the culture that leadership gets passed on. That even though it gets passed on as to the political culture that like happens is like something to be debated, but as to the transition, there is that like passing on of someone serves their term, and when the term is done, they move on. But
exactly.
Across the continent, particularly West,
we still have to meet some standard tests. Let's see when the government changes heads. Finally, it has happened in local government. Let's look at national government if it should happen. It's got 10:31.
Power Talk, 9 a.m. to noon.
Okay, let's continue with our discussion here on Thought Council. Feel free to engage us. We have touched base on a number of issues, gender-based violence. We're also looking at the succession within the African continent when coming to leadership. And I've just did a bit of a dipstick research pertaining to African women leaders. I think we had only 10, and most of them on an interim basis. So it really shows that it's not only young people who have been blocked from ascending to this position, women as well. It's still a bit of a big challenge. So guys, feel free to get in touch on some of the issues that we've been raising. 0861987000 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at PowerFM987 using the hashtag PowerTalk, or you can tweet me directly at Murio Muriano. So Nonhle, let's look at the, some barriers, to you know, to ascend. You look at South Africa, for instance. There was a time last year when they thought Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma might emerge as the ANC president and finally become the president of the republic. But you look at the continent, 10 in total, I mean, from long, long, long time ago, and most from an interim position. So in terms of women opportunities, are there opportunities, or are you guys still experiencing barriers to entry on leadership positions?
I think that most of Africa is deeply patriarchal. I think that our systems and our institutions are deeply patriarchal. So we need to dismantle those first. And I think that even with South Africa having, like, you know, women in parliament and, like, you know, having women as ministers in higher positions, it's still not enough, because the people who make the decisions are still men. You know, we're still being led by men. We're still, our leaders are still men. Like, the rhetoric that we speak is still patriarchal, you know, still misogynistic. So I think that we have a long way to go in terms of, like, recognizing women in, like, higher positions of leadership, and, like, having them be progressive, you know, not operating under a patriarchal system, because that can also capture you as a woman working within those confines.
Mm-hmm. But are you impressed, Datelisian, with the fact that the governing party, for instance, is, you know, through their Congress, they've taken a resolution of 50-50, you know, to say 50 women, 50 men. And now recently in Gauteng, for instance, David Makhura decided to do a slight adjustment, and they said, no, it has to be 50-50. And they took the matter to, you know, to the executive and to the officials to try and appeal, to say, because of the skill sets, we feel we just need a bit of a breather there. But they said, no way, David Makhura, 50-50. So are we making progress, you know, in South Africa?
I think it's quite hard, because when you listen to the narrative about appointing females to that position, it seems like it's something that we are doing so that it's a look at us type of thing. And I just sometimes question the, like, genuine intentions behind it. Whether is it you are put there because these men genuinely believe that you have the agency and the power to be able to execute on that mission. Because I think not being able to answer that question very, very genuinely does really impact how that woman is going to be able to run the office. That I'm like, you sit back, you're like, it's okay that we can have ministers be like 50-50, but for me that then has to begin to show as to the actions that the government takes. And if the actions are still very much patriarchal, and then there's a question to be questioned about what power do these women that have occupied these offices really have? Because, the year can't end and then we're still talking about gender-based violence when we're saying that we have a very, very big part of women in the executive positions of, like, parliament have this thing influence. Because you then also go as far as Rwanda, is that they'll tell you that they have 60% of their parliament being women. But what does that mean for the material conditions on the ground? And if there's no correlation, then I just think it's just purely for just window dressing. And I think we are just over that. But then also, even, like, beyond women, I think leadership has to begin to be very, very intersectional in a way of just recognizing that it's not just men and women who then live in society. That a big part of our demographics are much more complex than that. In like very many ways, very, very non-binary, even if that's a hard conversation to have with the people that essentially have to vote, have to currently even also hold influence. And for me, that's where then young people become quite important, because I think we're the most equipped to really drive that conversation, to say, you know what, maybe 20 years ago, we could have just had the conversation between man and woman. Okay. But now it's much more complex than that, because people identify differently and they have to be given that platform, because they too form a part of our country's population. But okay, we can't sideline them.
18 before the hour 11, 18 minutes to take your calls on 0861987000. If you want to weigh in into this discussion, my panelists are here. Comments or questions, they'll be welcomed. Before we move on to the issues of the recent xenophobic attacks that we see, Tate Maphasa, I want to quiz you on one thing, especially when coming to African leadership. We have this outstanding African called Dr. Mo Ibrahim, came up with the foundation, okay? And in this foundation, he incentivizes African leaders to say, let's look at the governance. You know, and if you are doing things properly, you know, incentivize them. He supports them. They get the awards, the Dr. Mo Ibrahim Award. In one of the, I think 2 years or so, he didn't issue the award because he says the governments, the entire African, you know, they're going south instead of north. But one thing that he said in one of the forums, he said to the African leaders, do you want to leave office while you're working on a cane? He says, Barack Obama at the time, he was 45 years, he was the president of the US. You've got the traders from Canada and so on. So it seems as if, within the African continent, it's a club for old men. So even a person of Mo Ibrahim stature can't even influence their thinking. Now, as young people, how do we start working on these issues, changing mindsets? Or you want to go the Arab Spring route?
Either way.
When I go the fees must fall route. Okay, how do we deal with this issue?
I think there's a problem with African leaders who genuinely believe that history owes them something, you know? And I think we are past that. As he had said about, we need to start dealing with the material condition of African people, right? We don't eat history, you know, we can't eat history, we need to eat food, you know. But in terms of how do we deal with African leaders who are going AWOL in a sense, right? I think it's important to have institutions that are consistent in how they apply themselves, but that are also committed to democratic precepts, right? And I think institutions such as the African Union and the regional organizations, those haven't been consistent in how they apply themselves, right? Indeed. So we do have a charter on democracy, on elections, and how we conduct ourselves, right? But there's been inconsistent implementation of those principles, right? Case in point, in ECOWAS, I think I can't remember his name, Jammeh, I think.
Jammeh. Who accepted the results and later declined
exactly.
And had to be forced out.
ECOWAS was quite swift in responding to that, right? But then we have Robert Mugabe in the previous decade, where the results are disputed. It seems that the opposition have won, but then SADC responds in a different way in how they mediate that situation, right?
And we spoke of quiet diplomacy. All right, let's go to the callers now. Let's start with KK in Midrand. KK, good morning. Your comment, please.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good, sir. Now, I would like to say women are their own worst enemies. Women don't support each other. For example, in the 2018 election, in this past elections, there was a party called Women's Forward Movement. Women did not vote for that party. Then that party said that it was going to advance and put women's issues forward. But they opted for the ANC, that is abusing them, that is not taking them seriously. In the ANC, Women's League, instead of supporting a woman president, they didn't. So women never support themselves. They want to appeal. They want to appeal to men. They are abusers, so that they men must support them. They men must promote them. That will never happen. You'll forever, as women, keep complaining. This and that. You'll never get away unless you take yourself seriously. Babes Odumo was abused, even filmed herself. But what happened after that? She goes back to the abusive men. So women are their own worst enemies. They must stop complaining and take responsibility for once. We can support, some men can support them all they want, but if they don't support themselves, they are going nowhere fully.
Okay.
We'll never be complaining in 100 years' time.
Point taken, KK from Midrand. I remember that political party, Women's Progressive Party, or something like that. But was it appealing to women? That's a million-dollar question. Nina Craigwell, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, how are you?
Just 2 points. The first point is this. It's not enough to have 50% of women in parliament if, in fact, they are an older generation. Because the older generation has not actually become activated about the kind of issues that the younger generation of women who have been involved with social media and, you know, the outcries globally about women's status, have been. So in fact, it has to be a much more complex shift, not only to women, but actually to younger, very strident women who are prepared to fight. I just want to make a very quick point about what this the last caller has said. The truth is we haven't analyzed sufficiently the problem of the grant system and how it impacts on voting behavior in this country. It's very important. So, in fact, there's an underpinning of tyranny with the grant system, which means that people who are not sure about the privacy of their vote are obliged to vote for the ANC for survival. So we don't know how many people were committed to the Women Forward movement, and that's a big pity. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much. Nina there from Crickle. Before we respond, let's go quickly to Montana and welcome Pedro. Pedro, good morning.
Hi, colleagues. We need to focus, of course, on the gender-based violence, thoroughly do research and deal with it. But I think we need to deal with the general current criminality in the country, violence in the country, which I think is also one of the reasons why there is poverty and unemployment, because people are discouraged from becoming entrepreneurs because they're afraid of being robbed. You know, so I feel that the country needs to deal. And how do we restore the dignity of the police force? How do we ensure that they are respected, they respect themselves, and they implement the laws come into the space to arrest like people that killed people yesterday? Do we have somebody called the specialized top dog police guy today? I don't know.
Like the old Peter Bedford, when there was an issue of a kidnapping. The first thing you think of is that the detective.
And he solved the problem.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know he's going to solve the problem. The criminal is going to run away because they're going to get caught. You know, how do we restore the dignity of the police force and ourselves to respect each other?
Pedro,
how do you do that?
Something very interesting. Mr. K. Makubele is here, the spokesperson of the police, at our profile interview today. So I'll post that to you. I'll post that question to him. So,
sure.
Yeah. All right. Pedro there from Montana. Nonhle, here's an issue from Nina saying that the 50-50 rule is not enough. And secondly, he's speaking about, you know, the generational differences to say women who are older, who are in leadership positions, they might not be, you know, au fait with issues that are challenging women currently as opposed to young leadership. And we've seen parties like the EFF having the likes of Naledi Chira from the Fist Must Fall movement in there, ANC, Nompendulo Mkhatshwa in parliament. Is that the right way to go? And the issue of 50-50?
Okay, so on the issue of 50-50, I agree with Nina. It's not enough. It's not enough for the very same reasons we've all been speaking about, is that like if you don't dismantle the patriarchal, if you don't dismantle patriarchy, you won't be able to get through what you want to do. You won't be able to initiate the kind of transformation that you're looking for, because under what discrepancies and guises are we working under? We're working under a patriarchal like discrepancies, which means that it makes it difficult for women to, you know, go through the glass ceiling and actually achieve what they want to achieve. I mean, and Nina's right, it does make it even more difficult that we have an older generation that is duly, that still thinks in a black and white way when we live in a very complex society. And when you think about like our generation now, like I'm a millennial, and when I think about our generation now, our lives, our identities are not just attached to, you know, we survived the apartheid generation. Our identities are more than that. They are more personalized than that. Like, you know, I might be queer. I might be non-binary. I might be a transgender. I might be, and there's not enough representation of those kinds of identities that exist. Like, we purport to say that we live in a rainbow nation, yet what kind of rainbow nation are we actually talking about when we don't understand the amalgamation of different identities within this country?
Well, Pedro is saying women are your worst enemy. He talks about the political party that was formed for women. And
I
so
think,
on.
Yeah. I think that was, I mean, listen, I don't agree with him, obviously, for various reasons. Firstly, we live in a society where our democracy is fairly new. 25 years is not a lot, right? We live in a society where we're still attached to the apartheid era and what happened there. We live in a country where people don't understand the electoral system and how it operates. Mm. We have an electoral system that says that there are different political parties, yet we have three big political parties who fight against each other, and we need to choose between those. And because you want to see some kind of change happening, you look at like parties like the Progressive Women's, you know, I'm sure they would have like good policies and good frameworks and good, but it's like it's about the seats, it's about the power that already exists. Like they don't have enough power to condition the kind of change that they want to, so they have to, we rely on the big three to like, you know, fashion that kind of change. So it's difficult when you're living in a society where you don't understand the electoral system, and when the electoral system itself is complicated, because we can't negate that it's complicated. You can't say women are their worst enemies because they didn't vote for a woman party. Like, are you serious?
All right, I just want to weigh in. We'll come back to that. Let's go to Kevin. Has been holding for quite some time in Sunnyside. We'll come back to that. Oba King, Kevin. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Yes, Kevin.
Yeah, I heard one of the gentlemen there was talking about African leaders, they need to be held responsible and stuff like that. I was not too much informed about his information, but I want to make this point clear to all Africans. Decisions made in Africa is not made by the leaders or by the politicians in Africa. It's made out of Africa. It is made by the European Union, by the Western world. Let me give you the case of what is happening in Cameroon. You see, like, what is happening in Cameroon now? There's a serious crisis now, and people are losing their lives day by day. But even the AU cannot stand for it to do anything. Now it is being called in Switzerland for a peace dialogue. This peace dialogue, why should be the Swiss government calling for a peace dialogue? Because they have interest in Cameroon resources. Now the president took upon himself to call for a peace dialogue. How can a president call for himself, call a peace dialogue, then he wants to be the chairperson of the peace dialogue? This is what is happening in Africa. Africa is divided into smaller parts.
Yeah, Kevin.
Which means South Africa, Congo, and some other parts, they have their own business arrangement. They don't care what happened to the rest of the people.
Yeah. Okay, Kevin, from Sunnyside, point taken. As long as we are still funded by European countries, obviously, they will call the tune. Yeah, Oba King, you want to respond?
I mean, firstly, to just Kevin's point, so even the funding mechanisms of the AU, big part of their funding does not come from the continent. Mm-hmm. So there's a question there about sovereignty. Mm-hmm. But I think what is also even sad is that you find that in West Africa, particularly in like Francophone countries, many of them still have very, very close ties with their colonial masters. So their money is like printed in France. Some of them still pay colonial tax for their infrastructure developed during colonial times, without taking into account lives that were lost for just even that like infrastructure to be built. But on the point that Pedro made about women being the worst enemy, I think firstly, that type of narrative is half-baked and probably not even baked at all. And precisely for this reason is that when you think about it in the political context, is that Cyril Ramaphosa needed $500 million to just run an internal election. So now you think about it for opposition parties that have to do two things. Prove to the constituency that the person holding power is not competent, and then that you're competent. You're asking someone who now has to vote to make two choices. And to be quite frank, if you don't have the financial resources, if you don't have the machinery required to be able to actually have a voice in parliament, because parliament also has a lot of portfolios that you need enough seats to be able to cover all of them, that you then begin these really, really unproductive conversations about how women are also not supporting each other. But even before that, there's a part of really, really engaging about how women are just socialized, and also how like systems play into putting women against one another rather than actually put them to like collaborate. That I'm like, you can't speak about the state of women without analyzing how society receives and like nurtures them, which in most cases is at their own expense.
Yeah. All right, it's gone 3 minutes. Let me go through the tweets very quickly. Lentless black vendor man. to the handle. Our leaders have lost the grip on African people. Our three miners in Lili Mine are trapped for 3 years already. Mm-hmm. No plans to bring them to the surface. Vendor pensions fund is still unpaid 20 years later, it's sad. These are the realities. Tabogo Pinar says, I think the opposition parties will provide ideas if the ruling party was matured enough to give them credit where it's due. We won't go anywhere because all the ANC thinks about is holding on to power, not the common man. Hashtag power talk. And I think the final tweet, it's from Chingaira saying, honestly, I don't know why some women have a problem with the wedding our women, especially if it comes from a good heart. Context matters in this case. I mean, women themselves call us Banna Barona, and we make no issue out of that. That's Chingaira. Sorry for butchering your name there. And Ben Mataila says, the issue of gender-based violence is an easy one to deal with. If a man found raping and killing a woman or child, that perpetrator must be castrated. You don't need to spend billions of rand towards that, enforce the law. Well, very strong words there. All right, as we wrap up very briefly, unfortunately, we didn't touch the issue of xenophobia. I think the issue of gender-based violence and the issues of leadership are quite important. Give me your closing remarks. Pass.
I think a lot of good things have been said. Good conversation has taken place. I think going forward, though, we at an institutional level, again, we appeal to people in power to actually listen. Yes, they've listened and they've heard everything that's been said, but to be proactive and have the political will to implement, right? Yeah. And we also need to commend and also implore young people to continue doing what they're doing, right? Yeah. To continue challenging the status quo, to continue standing up, to continue questioning, right? And I think that's the most important thing, questioning. Because without questioning, then we can become complacent, as Obakeng has said. And so those are my closing remarks.
Well, I think you closed beautifully. 30 seconds, Tato Obakeng, and then I'll close with Nontle. Obakeng, very briefly, 30 seconds.
Okay, so firstly, I think it's quite important that we look at taking part in the democracy beyond just elections. I think the idea of following your vote is one that has really stood with me quite a lot, because we all know that whenever leadership becomes complacent,
yeah,
it is the act of active citizens that like really, really gets it moving, particularly young people are at the forefront of that. Mm-hmm. And in a country like ours, where people under 30 constitute over half of the voting population, mm-hmm, it's important to vote, but also follow your vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And wherever you are, please do something.
Nonhle, follow your vote. Closing words.
I'm really sad that we didn't get to touch on the xenophobia, because I think that it was quite important. I think that, you know, as a gender-based violence activist, I think that you can't talk about gender-based violence and not talk about xenophobia, because they both stem from the same kind of like violence system. They stem from the same kind of problem, the same kind of issues. So I think that I would have loved to have that chat, but now that we've had this chat about like gender-based violence, I feel like we need to start implementing and stop talk shopping, because we're beyond that now. Like it's not enough to just be having parliamentary sittings and saying the same thing that you've been saying since the summit. Like things need to get done. Businesses, government, civil society, we all need to come together and start doing things and putting actions, plans in action, so that we are able to tackle gender-based violence accordingly.
I think we must take this opportunity very briefly to continue the Thought Council and just focus on issues pertaining to the attacks, violent attacks that we saw, particularly in Gauteng, Johannesburg and Tshwane, sparked by different issues. And we've also heard about the issues of the proliferations of guns in the country and some of the things that we need to deal with. All right, let's start here. Thulani, there's always this discussion whether this issue is xenophobic attacks, because there's all these schools of thought. Some people are saying it's not xenophobic attacks. You even had the president on a continental stage during the funeral of former President Robert Mugabe saying categorically that South Africa is not a xenophobic country. We are not xenophobic. So you hear people saying it's illegality. So what is your perception in terms of that? Because we talk xenophobic attacks and whatever, but then you get a pushback from the president and from other members of society saying that South Africans are not xenophobic.
I think firstly, it's a bit frustrating to have that kind of to hear that that all of this can be attributed to just criminality, right? Mm. And I think part of my discussion, what really I was going to focus on, was the centrality of the state in perpetuating a particular kind of discourse that really scapegoats migrants, foreigners, but also in using the language of criminality, it obfuscates itself from accountability, right? And so when you start viewing xenophobic attacks and Afrophobia or xenophobia or whatever you want to call it as a political process, then you attribute it then to different segments of society who contribute to that, right? But then when you say it's a criminal attack, you leave it to the individual, right? Because a criminal attack can be attributed to just one or two deviant individuals in society, right? But then when we start to understand it and call it what it is, which is xenophobia or Afrophobia, then we start to recognize that it has broader implications, right? And that many of us as society and the state itself are complicit in the violence itself.
Okay, that's why, for instance, how do we reach a conclusion? And I just want to base it on the reality of what the president of the republic said, the commander-in-chief. He said South Africa is not a xenophobic country, and what is happening in our country, it is not xenophobic. And he even mentioned the stats to say in the 10 people that died in these violent attacks, 2 are foreign nationals and 8 are South Africans. Over again, if the president says that, how do we come with a different narrative?
I mean, the president is not Deputy Jesus, so it's not like whatever he says goes. That I think there is room for some of how we define things to really, really be contested, which is what he just did right now. That I'm like, there's a part here that I think many of us are also complicit in, which is how we describe other Africans living on the continent. Mm. I mean, particularly living like in South Africa, is that if you go to townships or like that I'm like, a big part of that language is also very, very dehumanizing to the point where people feel comfortable to even break into these into the other Africans' shops, loot and stuff like that. That I'm like, that can only be possible once you have really, really not saw these people as like equals from the get-go, because you would not go and do the same thing koshopong ya abuti pitros or something like that. Do you know what I mean? That I'm like, firstly, whatever the government tends to put out is also in protection of their own position. That I'm like, that is when then it then becomes important to hear other like opinions that then challenge that, to say, you know what, I know that you're saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is the case, but actually this is the case. That I'm like, the president is not Deputy Jesus, and we shall not take whatever he say without a pinch of salt.
All right, now let's talk about some of the views that we normally hear, as we are about to wrap it up. Some of the views that we hear, people raising concerns, Nontle, about the open borders, saying the fact that we lack border management, what it does is it allows almost everyone, criminals, human traffickers, drug dealers, just to come in to say, migration is an international concept. But in terms of migration, there are processes and policies how we accept or reject people into countries. But to say our border management processes are flawed, and that's why we're having these challenges. What do you say to that?
I don't think we're having this problem because our border border policies are flawed. I think that's a separate issue on its own. I think that can be dealt with as an issue that needs to be like for better like access and for better like control or for better whatever. I think that's a different conversation. But I think that like to negate that xenophobia is happening is not happening because of the borders. It's happening because South Africans live beyond the poverty line and feel like they are owed something by this government that is not doing anything. So then they take it out on foreign nationals and use them as a scapegoat to be like, you are the problem, you are taking the jobs, that why unemployment is high. But unemployment is high because our economy is not doing good, because this government is not doing good. So I think that the to talk about the border is, again, one separate thing. But to talk about xenophobia and like how it's manifesting in this country, you can't. What Cyril is saying is actually deeply problematic. To say that xenophobia is not a South African thing is to negate the fact that it's happening. Like, you're absolving the fact that it's happening. You're reducing it, exactly. You're reducing it to something that is to criminality. It's not criminality, it's xenophobia. And you need to understand that your country is the one who hold these kind of like moral values that have pushed them to a point where they are now killing or fighting other foreign nationals. And I mean, I hate the word foreign nationals because they're not foreign. They're immigrants. They're migrants. You know. Yeah.
Okay. To just jump in there quickly.
Can I just say something about that? Let me just take one call. Okay, sure. We'll come here as we give out the closing remarks. Let's go to Smatsatsa and Kwatema. It's been hold. Smatsatsa, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. You know, this xenophobia thing is a lie that has been peddled by the media. They said it repeatedly until they believe it. In 2008, Thabo Mbeki was right when he said it was not xenophobia, it was criminality. Because what type of xenophobia is it? And in order to follow their narrative, the media conveniently doesn't mention that out of the 60 people who were killed in 2008, 20 were South Africans. In this instance, 12 have been killed, 10 are South Africans. But that doesn't, because that doesn't suit this narrative. It is downplayed. And then our president has got the guts to go and apologize. I don't know who he's apologizing on behalf of, because he must apologize on his behalf. I don't know what he apologized to. Did Nigeria, for example, apologize when their nationals were attacking the police here? Okay. You know?
Smatsatsa, drive safely, man. I could hear you on the road. Thabang Pretoria, as we wrap up. Good morning.
Hello, Mriwo.
Yes, sir.
I just want to ask your guests, how do they define xenophobia, and how do they relate that in South African context? If they're saying that South Africans are xenophobic, let them define. Because you cannot label someone something that you cannot define. It means you don't know it. So how do they define xenophobia, and how do they relate it to South African context that they so bold to call themselves xenophobic? Thank you.
Okay, Thabang. All right. Final points in terms of that question. Start with you, Mapaza.
Okay. I think we'd be remiss to use a dictionary definition about irrational fear of the other, right? I think a more cogent kind of definition in my attempt to define it, right, is embedded in context, right? Mm. That for me personally, it is an engineered kind of, what you call this? Engineered process of wedging divides between people, right, based on indigeneity. That's really what it is, right? And in kind of engineering that, you use language of force, you use language of regulation, of monitoring and othering, right, to achieve that end. And I think that's what the South African government has done. And in my focus, really what I was trying to say is that at an institutional level, right, at an institutional level, be it the primary bodies that regulate migration, being SAPS, Home Affairs, the SA National Force, and so on, there's a crisis. There's a crisis where human rights violations are being meted out on migrants, right? Mm. There's a crisis of the healthcare system not addressing or not even trying to provide care to migrants, right? There was a case in Pretoria where a woman gave birth in front of people, right? Because she did not have documentation. She was turned away, right?
All right. It's gone 18 minutes after 11 o'clock. Unfortunately, colleagues, we have to wrap it up now. This is a conversation that will continue. Obviously, it's not an event. It's a process. We'll continue that discussion.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.